Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Sakariasin. Police are getting closer to identifying the subject who slashed a $3 million painting in an Aspen gallery.
So now the cops say they have a suspect, but they're not saying who it is. They probably have enough for probable cause at this point.
And Mountain Rescue Aspen crews have been busy responding to emergencies in the backcountry. Also, the number of vehicles coming into Aspen remains flat as sales tax revenue increases.
Sales taxes are continuing to grow. They're up 3% year-to-date through May, which would indicate that there's continuing to be more guests, more spending, more economic activity, but the traffic is flat.
Meanwhile, further west, firefighters are battling blazes, some with success and others not as much.
In some ways, it's really impressive how quickly the firefighting resources respond on these kinds of fires. There are a lot of people and the conditions aren't going to take into account where people have decided to move.
Finally, Marble residents are making noise over increased ATV use in their backyard. Joining me in the studio this week are Jason Auslander, a reporter for the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. And later, Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent, will join me via Skype. In the studio, I have Jason Auslander. He is a reporter for the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly. He's the editor of the Aspen Daily News. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here, Carolyn.
So let's start with cops and courts. Jason, that's what you primarily focus on besides Pitt and Canny. And you had a updated story in Thursday's paper about a art slashing.
Yeah.
I don't even know what you call it.
$3 million painting that was slashed two
Only
months ago.
Only an Aspen story.
Right. In the gallery right at the base of Aspen Mountain there that has – yesterday I was standing there talking to the owner and I looked over and I said – is that sculpture next to me? Is that an original Salvador Dali? And he was like, uh-huh. So this place has some pretty fancy stuff in it.
One painting costing $3 million is probably not something that you see every day.
Maybe
they all have one of those.
Yeah, totally.
It's Aspen.
Somebody came in and ran in, slashed it with something. A man apparently disguised in some way, slashed it and ran back out again. And so the police have been working to find out who this guy was. They tracked him from cameras in the core past City Market, and he disappeared into the East End where there aren't as many cameras.
When did this happen?
May 2nd. It happened May 2nd, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The guy, somebody had been calling beforehand asking about this painting, in particular by this New York artist named Christopher Wool.
That's the interesting part of this.
Yeah.
One of the interesting parts.
And had called three times. And then, in fact, the same day, the owner of the gallery told me he left and said to his assistant, who was alone in the gallery, this guy may be coming in, so give me a call if he comes in. And sure enough, he did. Not quite
the same
way.
He, of course, thought he would be making a sale and not reporting a crime to the police.
Exactly. So now the cops say they have a suspect, but they're not saying who it is. Bill Lynn, the assistant chief, told me that they probably have enough for probable cause at this point, but they want to shore it up and make sure that they can make a stronger case.
He said something about the search warrants being complicated.
Yeah. What they did was get search warrants for places like Verizon. So they're waiting they clearly know who this person is. They likely have a cell phone number, and they want to see if they can prove he was in the area. I think is probably what they're doing. I don't know that for sure, but that's my guess. This is a multinational group of owners of this, so they're probably not in the United States, which complicates things a little bit more, I'm guessing, as well. So it is an interesting story. Only in Aspen, right? I don't know. And I had heard initially that the owners didn't file an insurance claim on it, which you would just assume that that would be it. And Bill told me yesterday that they believe it was financially motivated. However, that could be a million different things. So,
and still no insurance claim to your knowledge.
He said he didn't know. Okay. So I'm not sure where that is on that. But
the most fascinating aspect of this story to me, which I guess, is obvious once you think about it, but that paintings are owned by LLCs with multiple interested parties. Like,
well, I mean, they're treated as investments a lot, you know, so it's not that.
Right. It's not that weird.
The art world is a weird place, you know. Like, I tried to get a hold of the artist through his gallery in New York, and, you know, the woman tolerated my first inquiries about it and then never called me back again and was, you know, like, clearly he doesn't want to talk to you, little man.
Right. So, right. Your beat goes from that kind of crime to. Then you just get transients who are, like, kicking people and biting cops.
Right.
Which has been the other headlines this week. And Landon Smith, who's I'm talking about, is the cop kicker, and he bites people.
Right.
He's been in and out of jail for almost a decade here.
Yeah.
And now he's – what's the latest on that? He got probation for all of it, and he's been in Picken County Jail for, gosh, how long?
2.5 years now, more or less. You know, he got out for a few hours one time, but got drunk and kicked a cop again and got back in jail.
Right.
Yeah, I think they're looking for, you know, I think one of his main issues is alcohol. And if he can deal with that, he can maybe have some semblance of a, you know, existence that's not wrapped up in the police.
Right.
So I think that's what they're hoping to do with him. But, you know, on a bigger note, the police department's somewhat experiment hiring somebody to deal with these guys. Andy Atkinson is his name, and he's, I think, like the human outreach officer or something like that. He's done a great job. You know, I mean, he's really helped a lot of people that were on that cycle of going through the system on homeless-type charges of theft or sleeping in the park or sleeping in somebody's basement or drugs. And really helped. He's only been on the job for about 6 months now, and he's helped a significant number of people whose names appear in the cop blotters in both our papers frequently. So, on a larger note, I know he's trying to work with Landon. I think Landon poses some more difficulties than others, and also poses a somewhat unsympathetic figure in this community to people, especially the police. Maybe, I mean, you know, they. I don't know. I think he is, I guess. So anyway, I think Andy's done a great job, and I think it's commendable that both the city council and Richard Pryor and Linda Consuegra and Bill Lynn, you know, decided to gamble on it.
Yeah, I know there's other communities that are thinking about doing that.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. This is so much of what our local police are dealing with.
Yeah.
Is just crimes of, like, minor mayhem. Committed by people who are
intoxicated or mentally ill.
And one of the cool things that Andy does is, you know, he's got time now to wrangle all the resources that are available in this valley. Because there's, you know, this is a progressive thinking valley with access to money, which is important. So there are nonprofit services available for a lot of these people, you know, available for any number of people who can't afford treatment or, you know, something like that. And, Andy now is an expert on where to go, what's available, how to get it.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a headline that you both had about, and we did too, about some rescues that happened in the backcountry. And this happens this time of year when you get a lot of people in town, not experienced mountaineers or acclimated to the altitude. Mm-hmm. And it keeps the mountain rescue Aspen folks pretty busy.
Well, you know, on this whole general topic, you don't hear about this in the winter because it gets dealt with when someone goes up on the hill.
Ski patrol, and
skis a run that's way out of their ability level. It gets handled by ski patrol. You know, they're put in an ambulance and taken to the hospital, and we never hear about it. But because it's the summer and you're on actual public lands, and it is dealt with by Mountain Rescue, which is an arm of the sheriff's office, and typically these are more challenging type of rescue scenarios because you're not on a ski resort, you're in the backcountry. I live near, you know, right at the S-curves kind of, and really the entire 4th of July weekend, all 4.5 days of it, it's like there's a siren going by every 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, it's nuts.
Yeah.
When the population of this town, I think it, you know, it hits 20,000-25,000 people when all our units are full, it's just a law of averages.
Right.
There's so many people out there. Someone's going to hurt themselves.
For sure.
For sure. And you look at the trails, and they're just like ants going up the Ute Trail or Hunter Creek, and some of them are way beyond their ability level. Mm-hmm. And that was the situation a couple weeks ago. There was a guy from Kansas who got rescued from Thomas Lakes, where I think he had a like it was a fairly insignificant reason, I think.
Right, they got lost. They just got off the trail and they didn't know where they were. I'm sure they were freaking out, and they, you know, they called for help, which is you know, usually what happens here. I would say,
and then the one at Crater Lake over the weekend was acute mountain sickness,
right?
And that was about an hour before they got called to go help and investigate whether or not there was an injured climber on top of Snowmass Mountain.
Snowmass Mountain, yeah.
And he, it sounds like he was actually in trouble. Like he had some more serious.
Yeah, that guy got life flighted.
Yeah.
He did.
More serious injuries.
And, you know, and at the bottom of those press releases are, it's either, you know, make sure that you are acclimated to the altitude, that you bring enough water and you know what you're getting yourself into. And then there's another one.
They tailor it for every different situation, which is the best.
Right. And so the one for Snowmass Mountain was, please do not climb alone. And I'm looking at you, Jason, because you do climb alone. And I'm always like, why are you doing that? Please don't do that.
Well, the most obvious reason is that sometimes you can't get anybody to go with you. And then, you know, I still want to climb a mountain, so I'm going to go. Also, I live here, so I'm acclimated. I've been doing it for 20, 25 years. I, you know what I'm doing. That said, I know anything can happen, and I'm willing to take that risk. Like, if I die doing it, I'm fine with it.
Right.
I'm okay with that.
Sure.
So, but on the other hand, I don't take unnecessary risks. The one peak that I've climbed alone recently, I was behind time. I got to the ridgeline. It started to snow on me, and I said, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I made a good mountaineering decision.
Yeah, and you let people know when you were going to be out of the backcountry. So
that said, you know, if I don't know, and again, also, you know, a similar thing happened this winter with the guy that was on Pyramid. Was it Pyramid?
Oh, the guy who was up there for like 2.5-3 days
in the middle of that nasty storm. Yeah. That everybody 110% were sure that guy was
dead.
And he made it.
And he comes walking out.
That was crazy.
That was awesome. But still, he did the same thing. He was climbing by himself in the winter, which to me is completely insane. But whatever. And he hit a cornice and tumbled like 2,000 feet. And I don't know if this guy up on Snowmass Mountain did the similar thing. But I, you know, it's
well, they said that it said that. Snow was a factor because there's still a bunch of snow up there. So he slipped or a patch of snow he thought was stable gave way on him.
That was Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen, and you are listening to Valley Roundup, an analysis and commentary of the week's news with writers and editors. We now continue our conversation with Jason Auslander, a reporter for the Aspen Times. Well, moving on, if you want to talk about crowds, that directly relates to traffic.
Traffic and the entrance to Aspen.
Yeah. Curtis, you had a story about how traffic numbers are flat.
You know, I
thought
this
doesn't feel like it.
I thought this was interesting. You know, traffic congestion is undoubtedly an irritant. It's a community issue. It's a quality of life factor. And this is sort of on, I think this was spurred on by the city announcing they're going to do this mobility lab next year where they're going to come, you know, they're going to come up with a bunch of different options to try and get people to take alternative transportation. Get out of their cars. Really just go full court press. How can we do this? You know, we're going to have shuttles for people with their dogs and, you know, lockers in town where you can store your stuff or, you know, whatever it takes. They're looking for ideas now. Be interesting to see what they come up with, but I thought, well, why don't I see what the traffic numbers are looking like so far? And the director of transportation said, you know, they've actually been pretty flat for the last, you know, for 2016 and 2017 to date are more or less flat. And this is after some pretty, you know, 2.5-3% up every year post, you know, coming out of the recession. And the city, and if you ask the city in 2014 or 2015, they would say, yeah, this, you know, this is just going to keep climbing. And we're going to be getting we're really going to be hitting the point of oversaturation. You know, the suggestion is that we are seeing more use of sort of these alternate transportation methods.
Well, and also, is it possibly that the S-curves are being used as, like, that's all they can handle? People are understanding that. Mm. So, you know, if you can find a way through there on a bus, on a bike, some other way, then do it. And possibly the idea is already working because clearly the city council has said the S-curves, at least for now, are here to stay. Nobody's going through Morrell. And, you know, I have to admit, I cover the Elected Officials Transportation Committee, and I was sort of wrapped up in the momentum that they built with this $500,000 study with Ralph Trapani coming in to reanalyze all of this stuff and thinking, hey, great, they're finally going to solve this problem. But, you know, when they put it, and I'm not sure this is it's possibly too simple, but when they say basically all of that political will and all of that money to go across Meralt and quote unquote fix this problem is going to amount to between 2 and 4 minutes.
Right.
And I think if that's really it, and I think it's possibly too simple, but a pretty good way of putting it, like, is it worth it? And also, as we just possibly were talking about, or we were just talking about, as the S curves are a buffer, like a they can keep a certain amount of people. And I think part of the concern with Meralt is that if they do it, then there's going to be traffic numbers are just going to continue to climb.
Well, we lived in L.A. Those are six lane freeways on each side, and we're still sitting there. So, you know, my argument always is, well, even if you go across Meralt, you're still going into a two-lane road. I mean, I know it's different for going out. Yeah. You know, if you go out, it'll alleviate more out of town. Mm-hmm. But again, if it's 2 to 4 minutes, is it?
Yeah,
you know,
And millions of dollars and a bruising political fight.
Well, look, we just got the latest sales tax report from the city in our email this morning. Sales taxes are continuing to grow. They're up 3% year to date through May. So we're up 3% in economic activity, which would indicate that there's continuing to be more guests, more spending, more economic activity, but the traffic is flat. So that indicates to me that this is working.
That's pretty cool.
You know, and people are learning to live with this and just accept the fact that the traffic is going to be constricted, certainly during the high seasons. And, you know, if you can figure out a way to work around that, great. If not, then
suck it up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think that's demonstrating that you can have an impact. You can get people out of their cars. And so now they're taking what in a lot of ways is the next logical step and figuring, okay, well, how can we just keep pushing here? Because there will continue to be growth in some form.
If the S curves are here to stay, let's just accept that and move on.
I think a lot of people have.
Yeah. Maybe that was the message.
Maybe. I mean, again, there's no political will. They also haven't checked in with the electorate in 20 years.
True.
So.
And that's kind of what I was curious about. I was like, what kind of political fight is it? Is it going to be as bruising as we think it is? Or are people going to be like, we're sick of the S-curves?
No, I think you get a good point, Curtis, that if it's, you know, sales tax revenue continues to grow.
But yet traffic is flat. Like,
that says something.
And that was a good call to look at that. I mean, that's the key
I probably should have had that in my story on Monday or whenever.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't have had the numbers ready.
but there you go. You heard it here first. Sales tax up, traffic flat.
Okay, well, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thanks,
Carolyn. Thank you. Happy summer.
That was Jason Auslander, reporter for the Aspen Times, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. We now turn to Glenwood Springs to discuss the week's news in that area. I've got Randy Essex on the line via Skype. He's the editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent. The immediate news is there's been some wildfire activity along the I-70 corridor in the North Fork Valley, along with on the other side of the canyon in Eagle County in Breckenridge area. What do you know?
Well, it's super dry and super hot. We haven't gotten many breaks in terms of avoiding wildfires this year.
No.
I came back from Denver. We took Amtrak to Chicago and then flew back to Denver and took Mustang last night. So rode past the plume of black smoke you could see from the Breckenridge fire on I-70. And, you know, that's kind of, there hasn't been loss of life, but evacuations and so forth are the things that we really fear.
Yeah. And that took a turn. I mean, that grew very significantly within one day. The wind shifted and boom, it went from, I think, 300 to 850 for acreage.
Well, that's the Gutzler fire, which is in northern Eagle County.
Gotcha.
Which is the other big one. And John Stroud told me that on Wednesday, smoke was blowing back this way from that fire. And then there are big fires in northwest Colorado, too, toward Meeker. We were very lucky here on July 3rd with it was a relatively small fire, about 100 acres near Newcastle. But readers sent us photos where you could see apartment buildings with flames behind them, which is a scary situation. That one could have taken a bad turn, but it ran up a ridge and the firefighters were able to control it and did a really fast response to it. So the conditions are just prime for bad things to happen, and it's happening all around, but there at least hasn't been a really big one yet.
No, and you know, our sheriff put stage one restrictions in for fire.
Well, Garfield County had restrictions that were imposed in late June.
Okay. You had fireworks, though. We did not.
Yeah, there were fireworks canceled at Newcastle after the fire on July 3rd.
What was that, the Clear Creek one?
Yeah.
That was above the flat tops, or on the flat tops, right?
No, the hog, they called it the Hogback Fire.
Okay.
I don't know if it got big enough to formally get a name, but...
Mm-hmm. They knocked that down pretty quick?
They did. It blew up really... I mean, it was only 100 acres, but it was close to residences, as I said. And they were able to contain that and really within a few hours have it to a place where it wasn't a big concern. You know, there was a fireworks injury. Glenwood Springs went ahead with its fireworks. This was the second year of doing a low-level display, which is supposed to be much safer. And a guy called us yesterday and got his leg burned pretty badly. We're not sure yet exactly what happened with him.
From that display, from the commercials?
Fireworks display at Two Rivers Park. You know, Glenwood debated for a while about whether to do fireworks. Didn't do fireworks, didn't really have a community 4th of July celebration. And then the feeling is that these low-level fireworks by the river are much safer and can be controlled. And, you know, it was a freak accident that occasionally happens, I guess, with fireworks displays. There wasn't a bigger fire, so I guess that's a footnote to the bigger fire discussion. We've talked a lot on this show, and people talk a lot about humans encroaching on the forest, which of course is the ongoing debate, and in some ways it's really impressive how quickly the firefighting resources respond on these kinds of fires. At Breckenridge yesterday, they had a lot of resources. Near Newcastle on Wednesday, they had a lot of resources very quickly. But there are a lot of people, and the conditions aren't going to take into account where people have decided to move.
I think that fairly new facility at the Rifle Airport, as far as a fire response, will be
helpful. It is mostly research at this point, but the whole idea behind it is to identify the most effective techniques. And part of the reason it's located where it is that there are a lot of fires for it to study and in theory test new techniques as they develop.
Sure. And let's also note that there's fires all around our state, in New Mexico, in Nevada, in Arizona.
The biggest one in the nation was in Utah back in late June. I think that one calmed down a little bit.
Yep. And then it should also be noted that Thursday is the anniversary of this tragedy of the Storm King fire that happened in 1994, where, 14 firefighters lost their lives after the fire, you know, raced up the hill and they weren't able to get over to the other side on the ridge. So, you know.
A really solemn day in Glenwood Springs, and I'm sure that there are firefighters, usually some relatives, who come and hike the trail on the day of the anniversary.
So, segueing, Randy, the reason, the majority of scientists will tell you that climate change is a real thing and that we're getting hotter and drier, and I think the conditions of today are indicative of that. Meanwhile, funding for renewable energy and our energy department in the state, based in Denver, the energy office, is now being defunded. And you all had a story about how that will threaten local programs. The story was about, you know, there's local energy initiatives. And in this case, Ryan Summerlin did a story about the Colorado Energy Office, which funds certain things in Garfield County as far as renewable energy goes. And you guys talked to the clean energy...
The economy for the region.
Thank you. Yes, CLEAR.
Alice Laird, who's the director of CLEAR, said that we will feel it because it's a long-term partner. CLEAR has conducted a number of initiatives here. It just has to try to turn elsewhere for grants. One of the things that it does is energy efficiency assessments and offering people opportunities to save money in their homes, which is a simple thing. You don't really have to. To me, the virtue of clean energy, you can stay away from the supposed debate about climate change, is that businesses can make money, that individuals and businesses can save money, that there's an opportunity for innovation, an opportunity for entrepreneurialism, and a way to diversify and grow our economy. And offices such as the Energy Office catalyze that kind of thing. And to me, it's a shame to see the partisanship that plagues us at so many levels filter down to something that just plain makes sense.
Ryan Summerlin had a story that was printed on July 3rd about, again, this is an issue in Pitkin County too, and I think elsewhere in the valley, about ATVs kind of overrunning the backcountry. And apparently Marble has some issues with it now too.
Yeah, Marble, you know, people live there because it's out of the way. It's a mountain escape, but as so many other places in Colorado have seen, it's being discovered, and folks there say their tranquility is interrupted or disrupted, particularly by the off-highway vehicles and people roaring down the trails. We talked to residents who said, you know, they used to be able to hike in tranquility and maybe they would see an ATV or two. Now, one guy described even seeing a group of 20 or so. And I, you know, certainly people have their fun in different ways in the backcountry, but it's a lot different than, you know, people hiking or mountain biking or so forth when you have the fuel and the noise and so forth. And it's hard not to sympathize with the Marble residents who, I think it was just a couple of years ago, there was a scenic byway opportunity and they could have gotten some signs and, you know, a little bit more tourist traffic and spending and so forth. And the town opted out of that because it just didn't want to do anything to attract bigger crowds. So it's just a microcosm of the push and pull that's going on around the state. People like to recreate in different ways, and it's becoming harder and harder to find a place to...
For solitude.
You know, yeah, for solitude, for quiet.
All right, well, thank you for taking the time, Randy.
All right, bye.
That was Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, speaking via Skype. Thanks to my other guests as well, Aspen Times reporter Jason Auslander and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen, and you've been listening to Valley Roundup. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.